the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Now, if you thought we didn't have enough to worry about, the next item will probably actually raise another range of possible concerns, and it's the whole aspect of multivitamins. We've heard a great deal about nutritional supplements over the years and how they are vital because we have overprocessed food. The food that we eat doesn't contain the nutrients that we need, and so on and so forth. But, and it's an important proviso, the British Cancer Prevention Charity has actually now come up with a statement that multivitamin supplements could increase lifetime cancer risks by as much as a third. And they should indeed come with a tobacco-style health warning. Now, to address this somewhat disturbing finding, we're delighted to welcome oncologist extraordinaire Dr. Mohammed Khan to the programme. How are you, Dr. Khan?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Now, I can appreciate that this is a fairly disturbing finding to suddenly bowl out that supplements effectively could be more harmful than beneficial to our systems. Talk us through the research in terms of how you came up with this particular finding.
Well, Alex, I have been interested in cancer and cancer prevention from a very young age. When I was a teenager, I lost a loved one with cancer. And I decided I'm going to pursue a career in oncology. So I've been studying cancer, what causes cancer, how we can prevent it, and how it is treated. I think I was 15 when I started researching on that and went to medical and scientific journals. And my interest was more on the mechanism, what causes cancer, why cancer is there, and how we can prevent it. Most of the people in oncology are focused on the treatment aspect of it. What are the medications, the drugs, and the new strategies we can use to treat, which is very good and life-saving. But I have always believed that prevention is the best cure. When I came to England to work in the NHS, I was shocked to realize that the lifetime risk of cancer in England was 33%. That was at the turn of this century. Now, I'm also showing my age here. And in the 90s, it was 25%, which was quite high. For the human species, this risk should be less than 5%. So we were already having a very high risk. I started working in medicine and then specialized in oncology. And by 2017, the risk had gone up to 50%. That's one in two people had a lifetime risk of cancer. And I kept asking this question, why is this happening? What are the factors that we don't know about? Because I saw patients who were not smoking, not drinking, teetotal, almost saintly. They were having a very healthy lifestyle and still they were coming down with cancer. And genetics was thought to be one cause. But when you look at the studies which have been done, they show that there's only about a 5% role of our genes in contributing to the risk of cancer. And most of the cancer risk is coming from the environment. And there are factors in the environment apart from smoking and alcohol, which are contributing to it, but we did not know of. Now, it is being suggested that the risk of cancer could go high to 60% by 2030. And that is alarming. And in fact, the government is not giving out any recent data since 2017. So I won't be surprised if the risk has already gone up to 60%. And there is no focus on prevention. So when I started looking at the risk factors, I found out that one of the risk factors is that there is increased calorie intake. So having too much calories, too much food, carbohydrates especially, is predisposing us to cancer because it causes obesity and type 2 diabetes and can lead up to cancer. High body mass index is a well-known risk factor for almost all the cancers, if not every one of them. And then I realized if increased calories is contributing, does increased nutrition and nutritional supplementation can contribute to too? So I started looking at trials. Now, mind you, most of the trials which have been done on multivitamins and cancer are led by drug companies who want to use their products to see if they reduce the risk of cancer. And there's a precedent to that, that many trials have shown that eating fruits and vegetables, which are high in multivitamins, reduces the risk of cancer and heart disease. So since 1985, many trials had been conducted to see if synthetic multivitamins could also reduce the risk of cancer. And alarmingly, many of those trials came back positive for an increased risk of cancer rather than a reduced risk of cancer. But somehow that information was ignored, swept under the carpet, if you might say. I would say gross oversight by the companies who funded the trials and the health authorities and the doctors who participated. But trial after trial had shown two things. Number one, multivitamins can increase the risk of cancer, the synthetic versions, if they're used for many years. Usually the trial periods have shown 4 years or more. In fact, there was one trial, the CARET trial, which was from 1985 to 1994, published in 1994 in a very renowned journal, and that showed the risk was as high as 28%. And many other trials have shown that too. And secondly, those trials which have not shown an increase in the risk of cancer have shown no benefit from using multivitamins.
Now, clearly you work with the cancer, Killing Cancer Kindly, KCK, which we've worked about before. And we know that cancerous cells, effectively, they are high growth of cells that effectively go out of control. And is that one of the reasons why, in terms of the multivitamins, that they supercharge the growth areas and, in essence, kind of cause the cancer as opposed to acting as a defense?
Yes, that is a very important factor. You picked up a very important point. There are three aspects to it, to understand it very simply. Number one, every day cancer cells are born in our body. The estimates vary. Some people say a few hundred, some say thousands. I've even heard some experts saying there are millions of cancer cells born in the body every day. But that doesn't matter, because the important fact is our body kills all of them. We've got a very good anti-cancer mechanism in our body. So whether they're in the hundreds or thousands or millions, our body can kill them. There's a certain limit that our body has to kill these cancer cells. Now, if we are feeding these cancer cells, they have more chance of survival. Now, you can feed them with calories and glucose. They love to have glucose. Cancer cells pick up 10 times more glucose and growth factors compared to normal cells. That's why when we do the PET scan, the PET CT scan, you might have heard of it, we give radioactive glucose. So we take some radiation molecule and we coat the glucose with it and give it through the bloodstream and feed the cells in the body. Every cell picks up a little bit. Cancer cells pick up 10 times more and they glow on the scan. But they also pick up multivitamins, amino acids, fats, and all other nutritional elements which are needed to build new cells. Now, we have not done molecular studies on the uptake of vitamins, which Killing Cancer Kindly is planning to do in liaison with some international universities. I'm right now negotiating with some teams in Germany and America who are very keen to work with us on this aspect and to see how much the uptake of vitamins is in the cancer cells. But I expect it to be 10 times more just compared to the normal cells. And of course, there will be variation. Some cancer cells will gobble up more, some will gobble up relatively less, but it would be definitely much more than what the normal cells do, because cancer cells are dividing quickly. They're growing quickly, becoming bigger and more in number. So they need multivitamins. Without vitamins, you can't grow and you can't divide successfully. So that is one of the important things. We have always looked at reducing the caloric intake. We have never focused on reducing the nutritional multivitamin and other building block intakes. If you're providing excess of them in the body, more than the body needs, before the body can get rid of them, the cancer cells have a chance to eat them. Like Pac-Man, you know, they just go around and they gobble up whatever they can get.
So looking at the vitamins in general, because clearly there are certain things which have become embedded in our culture, such as vitamin C is good to ward off colds, for instance. Vitamin D is needed to actually deal with bone healthy care and so on. Vitamin E, likewise, vitamin B complex. There are other trace elements like magnesium, selenium, that many people would actually say are essential in terms of selenium, particularly in Britain because of the low levels of selenium in our soil. Is there any particular vitamins that have kind of become red flags to this? Is it a case of, well, if you're ODing on vitamin C, that can actually hypercharge the whole thing? Is it the combination factor, or have we not developed the sort of the focus as yet within the research?
That's a very good question. Well, firstly, the overview, when you take multivitamins, they have all of the vitamins in them. So the good, the bad, and the ugly, everything is in there. And they chuck in zincs and seleniums and all the minerals too. Now, starting with vitamin C, there have been many research and they have shown that vitamin C supplements does not give any benefit to the body when they are synthetic. The natural ones, like from citrus fruits and vinegar, are good. You know, even scurvy, the vitamin C deficiency disease in the sailors, it was treated with vinegar. So vinegar and citrus fruits, you take vitamin C, works. Take synthetic vitamin C, does not work, and probably doesn't do any harm either. But there is a big trend of using vitamin C. Why? Number one, vitamin C is a very good preservative. So everyone wants to add it as an additive to the food products. I mean, the food industry loves vitamin C, and that's why you get like 500% and 1,000% of your required daily allowance chucked into fruit drinks and food and all kind of edible substances to extend the shelf life. Vitamin C is very heat sensitive. When you make synthetic vitamin C, if it is exposed to even slight bit of sunlight or heat, it denatures. All that remains is the acidic value of it and no nutritional supplemental value. Vitamin D, many trials were done even during COVID. And we know that if you take vitamin C and vitamin D from natural sources, your risk of cancer goes low. But when they use synthetic vitamin D, it did not show any benefit. Now, vitamin E, sorry, I keep switching between vitamin and vitamin because I have been talking to English and American teams. So, you know, across the
I
pond,
think we get the general gist. Don't worry, Dr.
yes.
Garth. All good.
So I do apologize for that. So vitamin E has shown to increase the risk of cancer in the CARET trial. Vitamin D and vitamin E are also fat soluble. So once you take them, they're stored in the fat in the body, and there's no way to get rid of them except to use them. And hypervitaminosis, high levels of vitamins in the body, is a known disease. Like vitamin D, high levels can damage the kidney, they can damage the liver, they can damage the developing brain. And in children, high levels of vitamin D can cause mental retardation and learning disabilities. Now, coming to vitamin B complex, again, many trials, especially in Norway, they did two trials, Norvit and Wenbit, the Western Norvit trial and the Norway vitamin trial. They had shown they can increase the risk of cancer. So some of the vitamins are totally useless at best, and others are increasing the risk. Our aim is to do selective trials on every vitamin in different cancer types and to see which cancer types are more sensitive to certain vitamins and which cancers need more of a particular vitamin to grow and how much the increase is. But overall, the picture we have is synthetic multivitamins carry the risk of increasing cancer, and at best, they are of no good. They don't do anything, and they do come with a risk of hypervitaminosis, high levels of vitamins in the body, which can be toxic to the body organs.
Cancer research and cancer charities, whilst having very laudable objectives, are undoubtedly big business. Likewise, you've mentioned the pharmaceutical industry, huge business. In terms of killing cancer kindly, do you feel as though your own research and developments within this field is something which, in a sense, the human race requires? And in addition to that, is it something which you feel actually you've got to tread very carefully around those very monolithic structures that already exist that we've already mentioned? Because clearly there are an awful lot of interests, often financial, in both the aforementioned cases.
Absolutely. I was aware of this risk when I started the charity, and I had like-minded friends and colleagues and patients and their families who joined in and they helped us. Our main aim is to prevent cancer. We are looking at a world in which the human species is heading towards 60, 70, 80% lifetime risk of cancer. And I've often said, and I never tire of saying it, that there is no species of animals on the planet which has a 50% risk of any disease, let apart cancer. Why are human beings the most successful surviving species on the planet, having such a ridiculously high risk? And no matter how much treatment and drugs we can make, the prevention of cancer is going to be key in winning the war against cancer. We've had a lot of resistance. When I've approached pharmaceuticals and companies and research faculties, they've asked one question: how much monetary benefit would we get out of it? What's the profit margin? And I've said, there is none. We are saving lives. And they're like, we have to look at the financial aspect of it, and it's not going to make us any money. We are not interested. That is the general attitude, because unfortunately, the health industry has become a business. I love working in the National Health Service because it's a trust. It's not a business. But that is also changing very rapidly, unfortunately. And the research is being led by drug companies and by investors who want to see a return on their product. And prevention is a bit of a thankless job. If you prevent anything, you don't really get any reward for it. You don't sometimes won't even get a thank you for it, because people don't know what they have just been saved from, a total disaster and annihilation. But it's something which has to be done. To me, I'd worked 14 years on cancer prevention data, and I wrote a book. It's called You Will Wish You Were an Elephant, Killing Cancer Kindly. And when I took that book to publishers, many of them balked at the idea of printing a book on prevention because it didn't have the market value. And I was like, I need it to go out because I want to leave this message before I die. This is the biggest burden I'm carrying on my shoulders, that I know things which are increasing cancer, and that information is not being passed on to the people. So thank God that book did get published eventually in May this year. I'm very happy and delighted. It's a big burden off my shoulders. And I believe all the achievements the human race have made, they have come from people who have not prioritized personal gain and monetary incentives. And research, true research, which is beneficial to mankind, is not led by monetary benefit. It is led by a clear ideology of saving life and making this planet a better place. And that is the spirit for Killing Cancer Kindly.
Absolutely. And the text, once again, we remind you, You Wish You Were an Elephant, Killing Cancer Kindly. There's also the How, What and Why of Cancer, Separating Fact from Fiction, also presumably available from that point of view. How can people actually get in touch with Killing Cancer Kindly, KCK, of course? What's the best way of actually following and supporting your cause?
We are present on most social media platforms. So we are there on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram and Facebook. And we have a web page. In fact, we've got two web pages. And we also have information available in sort of publications. We are doing brochures. We are doing books, the two books you have mentioned. And the website, YouTube, I think, is the main forum where we have detailed videos which discuss all this information about cancer prevention and the rising risk of cancer and how to avoid cancer. And our team is always contactable through emails. We get a lot of emails. Recently, we've had a barrage of emails of people who are concerned, and you'll be amazed how much misinformation, disinformation, and lack of information is out there in the society. There's a lot of white noise on the social media. People are utterly confused, and they're confused and dejected and scared. So they don't even want to talk or think about cancer, because once they go into the information database on the internet, they are just they're just bewildered by the amount of contradictory information which is present there. And that's why the second book, The How, What and Why of Cancer, Separating Fact from Fiction, that took place, because we wanted to give clear ideas about what's fact and what's fiction about cancer. And the basic thing, Alex, I want to pass on to everyone is cancer prevention is very easy. Most of the time, the things we love to do, which come naturally to us, prevent cancer. We just need to know. what they are and how often we should do them, like waking up earlier in the morning, exposing yourself to sunlight. We had a discussion about it last year, I think. We had a wonderful discussion. And that helps your body generate a lot of antioxidants and detoxes your body. Similarly, having fruits and vegetables and having natural food and organic food and cooking fresh food, which might take an extra 15, 20 minutes a day, but tastes better, is much fresh and doesn't make you feel awful after eating it. All of these exercise that you enjoy, playing sports, laughing, humor, listening to comedy, going out with friends and having a good life, having a good circle of like-minded people around you. All of these things are very simple and they reduce the risk of cancer. Opening your windows in the house for 1 hour a day gets rid of the radon gas which accumulates in the house. That reduces the risk of lung cancer. 5 to 6% of the lung cancers are due to radon gas. So these are very simple measures, and there's an added benefit. The things that prevent cancer make you look younger and live longer. So that is an added benefit we all want. If we are going to live a life, we want it to be full of energy, younger, free of disease, healthier. And if you have a quality of life, you want it longer.
There you go. Dr. Mohammed Khan, as ever, an absolute delight and a fascinating insight in terms of some of the current work in terms of killing cancer kindly. Once again, we appreciate your time and hopefully we'll speak again in the very near future.
We look forward to that. Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank you on behalf of my whole team at Killing Cancer Kindly for the interview and giving us a chance to get the message across.
It's been a consistent line since the pre-pandemic days. We don't appreciate our pharmacists as much as perhaps we should do, because they are our healthcare heroes. And to talk us through why it's important to really take on board the fantastic expertise that the pharmacy can actually provide for us, we're delighted to welcome from the National Pharmacy Association, wonderful Andrew Lane. How are you, Andrew?
Morning, Alex. I'm good. Thank you very much. Fresh from a COVID and flu vaccination operation that I was involved in yesterday, in fact, in the pharmacy.
Well, there you go. And I think this is something that people still tend to forget, that rather than obviously dealing with their GP and obviously the very stressed aspects of most general practitioners' work, that actually pharmacists are fully trained and are indeed, as we say, healthcare professionals.
Absolutely, yeah. We've been giving the flu vaccine, for example, for the last 10 years or just slightly more now. And we see, on average, about 1.5 million people a day through pharmacy doors across the country. So we see an awful lot of people for various reasons, of course. Some of them might be just coming in for advice. Some of them might be coming in for a flu or a COVID jab.
No,
overall, very accessible, I think, is the key.
Indeed. I see at least 1.6 million people a day visit a community pharmacy for healthcare advice and treatments, which clearly, if that 1.6 million people, even a portion of that went to the NHS, there'd be much more problems with respect to that. So do you think the message is getting across then, Andrew, in terms of, as you say, we've been talking about this for the last decade, really, that pharmacists are just as capable, indeed, in many cases, possibly more capable than visiting a GP when it comes to the traditional ailments?
Well, certainly in terms of accessibility, we are there, we're open, and people are coming in daily, as we know. But there are a number of services now which we're starting to offer that the public might not be as aware of. So we have a blood pressure monitoring service, for example, for the over 40s. So if you are not on any current blood pressure medication, for example, you can come in, have a free pressure test, and that means then we can give you some advice. Also, we can give your GP a copy of your readings and just make the whole thing a lot easier to access. I think that's what it's all about here. You know, local pharmacies do provide a range of NHS services that people perhaps don't know they're there.
It's also worth noting that, as say, to qualify as a pharmacist, it's not just a case of you turn up, take an exam, and then go away again. Basically, it is a fairly considerable journey to actually go on. So we're not dealing with pharmacists who are basically random chances picked out and say, "Oh well, I'll just try this one here."
Absolutely. We've got a 5-year course for pharmacy, and many pharmacists opt to go into the community pharmacy where they see patients face to face. And we have a lot of trained staff to support that service, of course. It's not just the pharmacist who's extremely qualified, but we have an able team of qualified technicians that support the service. In fact, many technicians are employed in ensuring that the whole, making sure your medicine gets to you quickly, they are in the background doing that seamlessly. Perhaps the public don't see much of that. They'll access the pharmacy, they'll speak to the counter assistants often, and think that the only qualified person in the pharmacy is the pharmacist, and that's obviously not the case. So we have a range of people who are more than able to talk to the patient about their condition.
You see that half of us would describe a pharmacy as a healthcare environment, but just under a third of us would describe their pharmacy as a retail environment. Presumably it's a case of it's a blend of both, really, isn't it?
It is a blend of both. There are pharmacies available on the high street, as there are pharmacies available inside GP practices. So there is a blend. All those pharmacies, however, provide good, sound NHS services, advice to patients on a range of conditions. For example, we have one called the New Medicine Service, which helps people understand any medicines they might have been newly prescribed for their long-term condition. And you know, there are a raft of services like that that perhaps the public are not aware of that we can offer while they're in talking generally about their medicines.
And what drew your good self, Andrew, into the pharmacy industry as a career?
I think I like dealing with people front line, and there's a buzz really in talking to people about their conditions. Equally, you know, it always amazes me how little people do know of what the pharmacist can provide. And for example, just yesterday I was giving a flu jab, and the question was, oh, can I have my COVID jab while I'm here as well? To which the answer was, of course, yes. So, you know, I think there are a number of things like that that the public just think they can just come in maybe for the flu jab, but weren't aware that they could get their COVID vaccination at the same time.
There you go. And where would you recommend people should actually go to find out further details about their local pharmacy and so on?
Okay, well, you can go onto our website, which is the NPA, and that's www.npa.co.uk. You will always find a range of our members on there. You'll also be able to look up in your local magazine on the internet to see where pharmacies are available close to you. I mean, you can just Google now pharmacy open near me, and it will come up with where the old local pharmacy is there and available for you. And it'll give you the opening times. Many are open, obviously, extended hours as well, of course.
Andrew Lane, pharmacist extraordinaire, many thanks indeed, and keep up the excellent work.
Thanks, Alex. Much appreciated.
It's certainly a sobering thought when you realise that there are about 464,000 people admitted to hospital with disease-related malnutrition each year in England. That's pretty much the equivalent to 50 people being admitted to hospital every hour. And indeed, in the country, there are some 2.9 million people suffering from malnutrition in the country. So how do we actually address this? Well, we've got two folks who are beginning to address this huge issue. First of all, future health program directors and former special advisor at the Department of Health and Social Care, Richard Sloggart, who's with us. Richard, how are you?
Very well, Alex. Thank you very much. How are you? Okay.
Excellent. And we've also got clinical practice manager Danone, UK and Ireland. That's Anne Fazakerly with us. How are you, Anne?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Richard, I mean, the first time I read this, I have to say I did several double takes, because it seems quite astonishing that in a country which is supposedly one of the well-developed countries and so on, we effectively have so many people suffering from malnutrition. Were you surprised by this, or is it just a case of, as we have Malnutrition Awareness Week, people are actually just eating the wrong things, they're not eating enough, it's a cost of living crisis, or a combination of all of the above?
So I think there's an important distinction to make here, which is that we focused on disease-related malnutrition. So this is people with conditions such as cancer, respiratory diseases, stroke, people who've had a stroke, for example. And as a result of those conditions or related to those conditions, they have malnutrition. They're not necessarily, they have lost their appetite. They may not be able to feed themselves as much. They may be recovering from treatment. So that's where the 2.9 million figure comes from, people across England who have disease-related malnutrition. So we didn't look at the wider societal malnutrition, such as the cost of living, where higher prices and inflation are sort of coming through and making it very difficult for people to afford particular types of food. So our focus in the research was on that disease-related malnutrition area, where we found that 2.9 million figure for people affected across England.
And in terms of the reasons why, I mean, is it a case of, you know, I mean, the term itself, malnutrition, it means it's poor or bad nutrition from that point of view. Is it a lack of education? I mean, I'm just interested in terms of what are the causes or what are the indicators in terms of why we're faced with these phenomenal numbers.
So from the research side, there were two sort of factors that are sort of driving the sort of high rates and high costs. So one is the aging society. So as we get older, we're more prone to certain types of diseases. So particularly thinking about certain conditions such as dementia and certain types of cancer, for example. So an aging society is more prone to this. And also areas of the country where there are high rates of deprivation as well translate through to higher rates of particular diseases, and then across into higher rates of disease-related malnutrition. So on both of those counts, those explain some of the reasons why some of these costs are so high. And in the research, we projected forward, Alex, to look towards 2035 about what this might look like in the future. And we found that an extra 500,000 people could potentially be at risk of disease-related malnutrition by 2035 with an additional cost of £4 billion. This is a big problem today, but it's going to be an even bigger problem in the future.
Anne, you have seen firsthand the need for malnutrition to be diagnosed earlier. Is this something that you felt a bit like a voice in the wilderness saying this needs to be done and people have been ignoring you? Or is it a case that we're kind of addressing these issues?
I don't think it's a case of people ignoring. I think what it is just a lack of education around the screening process and the identification. And rather than just treating the condition, for example, cancer, you know, we need to look forward at what that condition might project for that patient in the future. And I feel like malnutrition should be discussed at an earlier point, so that we can identify it earlier and hopefully then prevent admissions to hospital if possible.
Now, Richard, we talked about the numbers, but obviously numbers also carry with it economic costs as well. And although people might feel they want to balk at the idea of costs to the NHS, but we're talking again over £22 billion being very much at the heart of this whole figure. So are there any measures that you feel can be put in place to make sure that we can actually start reducing that number? Or is it a case of, no, £22 billion it is, and that's where it's going to stay?
No, so I think there are things that we can do. We make the recommendations in the report. The main thing we're pushing quite hard for is better screening. So that's better screening of people in the community going through treatment or with particular conditions, or people as they go into hospital or go into care homes to get screened for being at risk of malnutrition. And if they are found to be, then to be referred and get the right care package and support that they need as they go through their care and treatment. So the impact of this can be prevented. The cost can be reduced. Most of the costs that we found in the report are in hospitals. So we know how much pressure those hospitals are under. People with malnutrition going through hospital stay in hospital longer than those who are not malnourished. So we can reduce pressures here on health and social care services by introducing some quite simple and effective screening tools up front. That does come with some upfront costs, but the savings downstream, I think, would be more significant. So this is a problem where there are solutions available. We just need to scale them and roll them out.
We often hear about the important need for joined up strategies and so on. And do you feel as though what Rich has described is something which is achievable? This is actually something which we can actually look to implement in the immediate future?
Yes, absolutely, because screening tools are actually being used currently. I just feel that they could be more effective if used a little bit better, and people were aware of the sort of implications of doing regular screening instead of just doing it once on admission, you know, keeping up with regular screening to make sure that issues are being identified early.
Richard, one of the most popular topics for conversation recently, of course, is the world of artificial intelligence, hosted, of course, by Rishi Sunak and Elon Musk, amongst others. Can that conceivably actually help in terms of sorting out regulation screenings and so on, or is that just another possible add-on cost?
I think there's some interesting things that you can do if you have access to better data and information on patients and patients obviously consent and providing more regular updates on their in this case on their weight and their and answering questions on their appetite and that being able to then trigger flags and alerts for health systems to say this patient's undergoing treatment for say cancer and they've lost quite a significant amount of weight. We need to make sure that they're getting the right nutritional package and support. So better data and information flowing between patients and their carers and health systems is, I think, a real opportunity to do that prevention piece that I talked about through the screening. So there are opportunities there.
And for people who wish to access the Future Health Research Centre report, Hiding in Plain Sight, Tackling Malnutrition as Part of the Prevention Agenda, where would you point them?
Ah, oh, thanks. It's futurehealth-research.com. So that's our website. It's on the news pages there for people who want to read more.
Richard Sloggett, Programme Director for Future Health, and Anne Fazakerley, Clinical Practice Manager, Danone UK and Ireland. Many thanks indeed, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, we've heard, of course, of the gender pay gap, and I think that gradually is being addressed after decades of challenges and so on. But what about the gender pain gap? Well, this is something which is particularly significant, especially when you bear in mind that there does seem to be a huge differential between diagnoses and time in terms of how those diagnoses are put together between men and women. And to talk us through some of the challenges with respect to that, we're delighted to welcome the author of This Won't Hurt, How Medicine Fails Women. That's Dr. Marijke Big. How are you, Marijke?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, excellent to connect with your good self. We've also got from Pontefract, Chloe. How are you, Chloe?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, Chloe, I want to come to you first. Could you just share with us your particular experience of how this delay kind of really impacted your own particular life experience?
So I waited 9 years for a diagnosis of endometriosis, and in that time the illness progressed, it spread, it's got worse physically, but then there's the mental aspect. You have people around you telling you, it's just pain, it's just a period, it's psychological, you're stressing. You have, professionals saying this to you, and you really do start to question yourself. So not only did it affect me physically, but it's really affected me mentally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm jaw-dropping to actually believe it's 9 years. I mean, turning to Marijke, I mean, as a sociologist, I mean, this is astounding, isn't it, really? I mean, 9 years? I mean, it's a decade, virtually.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I don't find it surprising. On average, endometriosis takes 8 years to diagnose. Lots of the so-called invisible gynecological diseases, so diseases that really affect women and their quality of life, but that women have learned to kind of mask and hide, have really long diagnosis times, and that leads to, proliferating health issues, ongoing chronic pain.
Share with us your findings on the gender pain gap. Again, what kind of were the key headlines that came out of this research? Because as I say, we've already gone in with Chloe's story, which is again just shocking in every sense of the word. But from your own perspective, were there findings which kind of confirmed your suspicions before you started the research?
Definitely. So today, Nurofen released this report on the gender pain gap, showing that this gap in women and men's experiences of pain has persisted, and indeed widened. It also shows that women in the UK experience much longer diagnosis times, like we've said, for similar types of pain. So not just when it comes to gynecological issues. And this confirms, what I found in my research for my book as well, just that there's this male-centric kind of bias in medicine where knowledge has shaped around questions that matter to male bodies. And that means that the knowledge is often lacking when it comes to women's bodies, which leads to dismissal, but also a kind of cultural sexism that very easily leads healthcare professionals to interpret women's pain through the lens of, oh, she's just being hysterical. So lots of women experience being dismissed. A lot of women have reproductive issues, around 30% of women, and only about half of these women will go and seek help just because they anticipate this kind of dismissal and stigma around these issues. So it's really just confirming what I already knew.
Yeah, I mean, you've raised a really interesting point there in terms of obviously women possibly listening to this might say, well, yeah, there we are. It just confirms what I've already thought. It's confirmation bias. So in essence, we'd still step away from that. What advice would you actually give to people who are possibly listening to this and they might be putting off a visit to their healthcare professional because of all the reasons we've just discussed?
Yeah, and it's completely understandable, of course. So today, Nurofen launched a pain pass. So this is a kind of tool that women can use to track their pain. And it also helps them kind of find a language with which to advocate for themselves and to push for doctors to take their reports seriously and maybe to seek a second opinion. So a big part of the solution is really, you know, validating women's pain and also telling women that this is a widespread cultural issue, and just raising that awareness will empower women to push for what they need. So that's a big part of the picture. The other side, of course, is healthcare professionals need training to become aware of these unconscious biases, and we need to change the culture from within medicine as well.
We've also got a senior medical scientist at Reckitt, Dr. Bill Lohi, with us. I mean, Dr. Bill, from your own perspective, that whole notion of unconscious bias, which is something we've talked about at length with many a scholar over the last few years here on the Midweek Drive, is that something which can be addressed by the sort of things that Mariëke has been talking about?
Well, I think it will certainly help. I think there's no doubt that this has been ingrained for many, many years, but we need to make progress with this. We think at the heart of this, there's a bias in society that sees women as being emotional in the face of pain and sees men as being brave and stoical. Now, that is definitely not an objective universal truth. That's a subjective bias, a stereotype. And that's the sort of bias that we need to push back against. But, you know, these are very ingrained, and it will take work, it will take effort. But we do believe, as Mariëke said, about tools like the pain pass, we think that can certainly help. We're absolutely determined to get this message out there and to train healthcare practitioners where we can. But it's, of course, it's about all of society. It's not just about healthcare practitioners. It's also about your friends and your relatives, because everybody can have these biases. So, yeah, we're really, really keen to try to push back against this.
It does seem to relate to the communication issue once again. Mariëke, talking back about the pain pass, and it's a free downloadable PDF tool. How can people effectively access it? And indeed, is it literally for all folk, whatever their gender happens to be, to maybe apply to see how they're progressing?
Yes, no, I mean, in theory, I suppose both genders could use this tool. It's mainly geared towards women just because, you know, they are at a disadvantage when it comes to getting the help they need. So all you need to do to download it is just go to Nurofen's See My Pain website, and you can just download the PDF there. And it really is a helpful kind of tracking device for your pain.
And Dr. Bill, there's lots of training taking place, of course, but I do know that health professionals are very stressed at the best of times. Do you feel as though the balance is being effectively achieved between obviously raising this issue and obviously not giving yet another course for people to actually go on?
Well, yes, I think we still definitely have work to do here, but we feel that the more we can raise awareness with discussions like this, and, you know, the more that we can bring this to the attention of healthcare professionals, then we feel there's light at the end of this tunnel, and we've got to keep doing this. You know, I mean, Nurofen is in the business of relieving pain, and that's a very compassionate, empathic thing to do. And when people are having their pain dismissed or not taken seriously, well, that's the opposite of what we're hoping for. So, you know, we really are hoping that everybody will help to advocate to close this gap with us.
Let's turn back to Chloe, if we may. Chloe, you've been listening to, obviously, Dr. Bill and Dr. Mariëke sharing some thoughts with respect to the challenges that are faced. Do you feel optimistic, as somebody who's obviously suffered as a result of this, that actually things will be changing?
You know, I think in some aspects, women health is it is believed in pain. For example, I am blessed to have a little girl. I had an unmedicated home birth at 18 years old. And now when I tell people that, you know, labour was a walk in the park, you know, it was so easy compared to an endometriosis flare-up, people know how hard labour is and they can relate to it. So after having that experience and being able to kind of give them an idea of how much pain I'm in, they can kind of empathize and relate, and you know, it's more understood because it's not just men in the healthcare profession that don't get it, it's women. It's, you know, I think it's society as a whole that is really struggling to understand women's pain, because women who don't experience pain don't get it either.
Marieke, can we just finally conclude by basically providing information in terms of where people can go to find out further information about what we've been discussing, and of course, how they can actually access that pain pass?
Yeah, of course. So you can go to the Nurofen website, their See My Pain website. So that's at nurofen.co.uk/See My Pain. You can also check out my book, This Won't Hurt, How Medicine Fails Women, for more context on how medicine has formed around this male bias.
Big sociologist and author, as you just heard, of This Won't Hurt, Why Medicine Fails Women, and Dr. Bela Lawhi, a senior medical scientist at Reckitt. And of course, Chloe, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on, folks.
The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
A year or so ago, we actually were featuring for the first time the YSL campaign in terms of abuse not being love. Of course, it isn't in any way, shape or form. And there are lots of stages and challenges that are faced with when we actually have this difficulty in there. Now, Mistake for Love, it's part of YSL's Abuse is Not Love program. And indeed, since its launch in 2020, more than 630,000 people have been trained in over 25 markets globally on IPV. IPV, of course, interpersonal violence and so on. To talk us through that whole system, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous folk today. First of all, the Abuse is Not Love lead from YSL. That's Julia Love. How are you, Julia?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. And we've also got poet and actor, the fabulous Dan Whitlam. How are you, Dan?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Julia, let's turn to you first. Again, for people who aren't familiar of, again, this particular issue and might sort of think this is, you know, I didn't realise such challenges actually occurred. Talk us through the actual campaign and why the Beauty is Not Love area of, again, addressing any warning signs of intimate partner violence, IPV, why it's such an important thing to do.
Sure, I think you mentioned it already, which is really important that people don't realise how prevalent it is. Actually, an estimated 1 out of 3 women will experience violence by a partner in their lifetime. And that's just the reported figure. So we know that it is actually the most common form of violence against women. It's severely underfunded and severely underreported. And so there is a lot of work to be done to help end this this abuse. And I think the first step is to fund organizations on the ground. That's exactly what Abuse Is Not Love does. We work with local grassroots organizations in our different markets, as you mentioned. And second, it's really about having that conversation. You know, we need to destigmatize talking about abuse. We need to give access to resources, and we need to make sure that people know it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to ask the question, is this normal in my relationship? And definitely get the help if they need it.
I mean, warning signs include things like jealousy, control, manipulation, isolation. You've got gaslighting or coercive control techniques. I mean, this is a nightmare. I mean, for supposedly civilized worlds of the 21st century, one might have thought such things would have gone out with Victorian times. Clearly, that's not the case.
Well, I would have hoped so, but it is indeed not the case. We see often that these warning signs, as you mentioned, control, intrusion, manipulation, isolation, they actually are big preemptors to escalate into more severe types of physical and sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And we really believe that if we can start to identify these signs from the get-go, we can try to prevent more violence from happening. Mm-hmm. And so prevention work and learning about these warning signs is a way to reduce IPV and to start to have that conversation about what does a healthy or an unhealthy relationship look like and what kind of behaviors shouldn't be okay to do to someone. So yeah, if we all can learn the signs of abuse, we can better seek or offer help.
Let's turn to Dan now, if we may. I mean, Dan, you feature in this online series in terms of how signs can be identified, etc. And you also have some of your own personal reflections on this topic. Share with us how you got involved with the YSL campaign.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've admired the beauty brand for a long time, especially their ethos and their goals and their humanitarian work. And my poetry itself is very focused around love and intimacy. And themes of issues to do with mental health. So when the brand came along and said they'd like to collaborate, it was an absolute no-brainer for me. And it was a case of receiving these very brave survivor testimonials and then reworking them into a poem. Three poems. And I think the benefit of using poetry here is that it's very accessible. It's super digestible. So we can talk about these really big issues, but in a way that seems a little bit more approachable than something that, you know, alternatively could be very wordy. So I think that's where I came in and was useful.
And clearly we don't want to conflate and confuse issues. These are not grand passions. These are not grand romances, etc. These are abusive behaviours. And there are nine signs of those things that are addressed in terms of mistaken for love. Again, was it using personal testimony that kind of led you to, in a sense, create these narratives?
Absolutely. I mean, I think first and foremost, you need to keep the survivor's testimony at the heart of all of these pieces. I didn't want to, you know, I was very careful to not fabricate anything, because as you said, you know, there's no romancing going on here. It's very brave accounts of things that have gone on. So, you know, there was a back and forth to make sure everyone was very happy with what I had reworked and rewritten. And I think the aim here is to raise as much awareness as possible and to educate people as much as possible. And these brave stories are going to be at the heart of that. And hopefully it will allow more people to potentially come forward and, you know, more people to educate themselves so we can, you know, try and stop this.
Julia, Dan's looked ahead to some of the aims of the programmes there. What are the future aims from your own perspective as YSL Abuse Is Not Love lead?
The Abuse Is Not Love programme started in 2020, and we have ambitions at least until 2030. We want to benefit over 2 million people, either through educational trainings or through support mechanics such as hotlines or psychological support. So that means expanding into more grassroots organizations and helping fund them. It also means continuing to publish thought leadership, so giving new truths and new information to move the needle at large. And of course, it includes additional awareness and educational campaigning, and that's, you know, at the heart of it is making sure that those work together. How do we have on the ground impact and at the same time spark a conversation?
And in terms of where people can go to find out further information, Julia, where would you point them?
So the series will be available on our social networks. For anyone who wants to get trained on Abuse Is Not Love, we have an amazing training developed by Dr. Beth Livingston on the abuseisnotlove.com website. And if anyone is experiencing any type of abuse and needs help, we have a directory as well on our website, Abuse Is Not Love, or you can visit womensaid.org.uk if you're UK-based.
And Dan, of course, people can also go to danwhitlam.com, presumably, to find out further details from your own involvement with the project.
Absolutely, yes. danwhitlam.com and also any of my socials, which is similarly just Dan Whitlam.
Fantastic. Dan Whitlam, British actor and indeed artist who features in the new series that we've just talked about. Julia Love as well, YSL Abuse Is Not Love lead. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Lovely speaking to you.
And if I make it through, it's all